One December Sunday, a children's Sunday school class was instructed to draw a picture depicting the Christmas story. Now, most of the drawings were of the manger scene, or the shepherds, or the wise men. But when the teacher got to little Johnny's paper, he drew an airplane with four people inside. The teacher could not keep the exasperation from her voice. "Now, Johnny, we're supposed to be drawing pictures about Christmas. What does this have to do with the birth of Jesus?" And he replied, "This is the flight to Egypt." Teacher was a little surprised, so, okay, well then, who are the people inside your plane? And Johnny pointed to each of the images and said, "This is Joseph, this is Mary, and this is baby Jesus." And the teacher said, "Well, who's the fourth person?" And he said, "Well, that's Pontius the pilot." Now, of all the elements of the Christmas story, this flight to Egypt, as it has become known, is maybe one of the least known and least understood. Now, we read about the account of this in Matthew chapter 2 a little bit earlier. We know that after the wise men came and was asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews?" Of course, Herod the Great caught wind of that, and in his paranoia, he was so afraid somebody was out to get him, out to take away his throne. And Joseph was warned in a dream. An angel came and said, "You need to get up right now, take the baby and his mother, and get out of town. Go down to Egypt where you'll be safe, because Herod is going to try to take the baby's life." And Matthew records that Joseph got up, took the child and his mother during the night. It appears that he acted immediately, gathered up their things and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of King Herod. And then Matthew adds, "And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" Now, those of you that have been here over the last few Sundays know that throughout the month of December, we are going through Matthew's accounts of the birth of Jesus, and we're looking at five prophecies that Matthew points to that were fulfilled with the birth of Jesus. But we come to this one, and it's made scholars wonder exactly what Matthew was doing. Did Matthew rip this verse out of its original context in Hosea and force it to fit something in his theology about Jesus? Is he making this a fabricated prediction that referred to something other than the coming of the Messiah, but he now incorporates it into his story? And many critics will point out that if you go back to Hosea, which we will do, he's really referring to Israel's exodus out of Egypt back in the time of Moses. But Matthew says this refers to Jesus coming out of Egypt. So there appears to be a contradiction. But that's not necessarily the case. As one scholar notes, frequently critics, and some Christians too, think prophecy means prediction, and fulfillment means the realization of a prediction. And from this, critics conclude these are fabricated predictions. But this charge rests on a great mistake, and sometimes Christians become confused by it as well. So this morning I'd like to take a look both at the passage in Hosea and how Matthew incorporates it into his truth about the birth of Jesus, but you'll find that what we often focus upon may not have been Matthew's intent at all. And in it we will see one of the foundational truths about Christmas that is often lost, but without it, Christmas would have no meaning. Let's first consider the scriptural similarity in this text. Matthew's quote comes out of the last half of Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, that says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." course, this is God speaking here through the prophet Hosea. Now, if you were to go through the book of Hosea, and it's the largest of the so-called minor prophets, there is one theme that runs throughout the book, and it is the theme of love. Specifically, God's love for His people. Now, we read in the early chapters that God uses Hosea's real-life marriage to a woman named Gomer to portray God's relationship with the people of Israel. He likens it to a husband and wife relationship. But now he changes gears. Here in chapter 11, he refers to Isaiah as Israel as being his son that he called out of Egypt. And it's true, Hosea is referring to the Exodus. He's referring to that historical event when Moses led the people out of Egypt and through the wilderness until they came to the promised land. The prophet pictures God as the tender father freeing his son from bondage. And this isn't the first time that we see the people of Israel portrayed as a son to God the Father. In Exodus chapter 4, going back to the story of the Exodus, the Lord tells Moses, "Say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son. And I told you, let my son go so that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will take your firstborn son." You see here, Israel as a people are likened or being called God's son. Now later, Isaiah opens his prophecy with these words in Isaiah 1 verse 2. "Hear, O heavens, listen, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I reared children and brought them up, but they have rebelled against me." Here he doesn't use the word son, but children. But it's that same relationship with the Father that is seen. Now, when you get into the New Testament, you also see this imagery carried over. John chapter 1, verses 12 and 13 states, "Yet to all who received Him," being Christ, "to those who believed on His name, He gave the right to become children of God. Children not born of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God." Now, what does it mean when we say that human beings are children of God? There's actually two ways that we can understand this phrase, both of which you find in the Bible. The first is that all people, all human beings, are children of God by creation. Paul identified this in quoting some secular poets in Acts chapter 17. He's speaking to the philosophers at Athens. In Acts 17, verses 27 through 29, he says, "God did this so that men would seek Him and perhaps reach out for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us. For in Him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own prophets have said, we are His offspring." Even the secular poets recognize that we all come from the creative hand of God. Therefore, Paul goes on to say, "Since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill." So we have this first way of referring to it, and you hear this. You hear people even outside of Christianity say, "We're all God's children." And to a degree, that's correct, because God created us all. So in one sense, all people are God's children by creation. But the Bible goes one step further. And there is another way in which God speaks of His children, and that's by adoption. Once again, quoting from Paul, this time from Romans chapter 9, verses 6 through 8. He writes, "It is not as though God's word had failed, for not all who are descended from Israel are Israel. Nor because they are His descendants are they all Abraham's children. On the contrary, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." In other words, it is not the natural children who are God's children, but it is the children of the promise who are regarded as Abraham's offspring. You see this secondary special way in which the Bible refers to God's children. And these are His chosen ones. These are His children by adoption, not merely by creation. And Paul delineates here, there's a difference. We cannot say that all people are God's children by adoption. Only those who have received Christ can be said to be His children. Remember what John said in John chapter 1. To those who believed Him, to those who received Him, they received the right to be called children of God. So while there's a broad sense in which all of creation is God's offspring, there is a special sense in which those who have come to God through Christ are His sons and daughters. And it's important to keep that distinction in our minds. Throughout the Old Testament, the nation of Israel was regarded as the chosen people, God's very own. And He refers to them as His children. And they were given every opportunity and advantage to know God and to make Him known to the neighboring nations around them. But if we keep reading in Hosea 11, we already read verse 1, but verse 2 says this, "But the more I called Israel, the further they went from Me. They sacrificed to the Baals and burned incense to images." God is saying, I treated Israel like a son. Israel did not treat Me like a father. Israel rejected Me. Israel rebelled from Me. Israel went away and did their own thing. And that's where Paul comes in and says, just because somebody was born with Jewish lineage does not make them a child of God. We are only children of God by faith, by those who accept Christ, who receive the Son of God into their own lives. And so we see that Matthew uses subtle symbolism to show that Jesus fulfilled what Israel was originally intended to be. God said, I want this people to be like My child, and I want them to obey Me and respect Me and love Me. The people of Israel, by and large, now of course there are exceptions. There was always the remnant that was faithful. But as a whole, the nation did not respond to God as their father. And so what Matthew does, not only here, but throughout his gospel, is shows that Jesus was the one who showed what being a son of God is all about. He fulfilled what God had intended Israel to be. But we come back to that question, does that mean Matthew is playing fast and loose with the Scripture in doing so? And I don't believe that he is. We have to remember that all of the New Testament writers, including Matthew, were Jewish. And the way that the Jews interpreted Scriptures, which was what we call the Old Testament, that's their Scriptures. They interpreted the Scriptures a little differently than we do today. They often gave a spiritual meaning or a new application to an Old Testament text without denying what the original text said. So he's not taking anything away from what Hosea originally said about the Exodus, but he's taking it and saying we have fuller meaning. We understand it broader in the person of Jesus. So he's not trying to take away anything that Hosea said. He's just saying we see a broader truth when Jesus came. So he's still taking the Old Testament literally, but he is applying the principle, applying the truth to Jesus. This isn't a prophecy in the idea of that it's a prediction. God did not predict through Hosea that the Messiah would have to come out of Egypt. That wasn't the point. But what Matthew does is he says Jesus echoes the Old Testament truth in his own life. And throughout the Gospel of Matthew, you see this being the case. And he's doing it in something that was very common and accepted among the Jews of that day. And what we find throughout the New Testament is this word fulfill, this idea of the Scriptures being fulfilled in Jesus. It means to bring to full fruition what had happened in the Old Testament, like the Exodus, like other events that took place. Remember, Jesus said to the people, just like Jonah was 3 days and nights in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and nights in the earth, meaning when He was buried before His resurrection. That's the sense in which Jews looked at fulfillment. Now, Jonah's submarine ride in the belly of a fish was not a prediction of what would happen to Jesus, but he fulfilled that story in giving it a broader sense and meaning. We see the same thing with institutions, such as the sacrifices. Jesus fulfilled all of the sacrifices you see in the Old Testament. And it's a profound study to go through and to see all that He accomplished when He died on the cross. The book of Hebrews shows that Jesus fulfills the role of the high priest. Now, that doesn't mean He was predicted to be. He fulfilled it. He accomplished it. He brought it to fruition. And so this is the sense in which Matthew is bringing Hosea's text into the story of Jesus and saying, see, even in this, what might seem to be an insignificant event, everything that happened to this child is a part of what God had been doing all along. And remember, Matthew was writing primarily to a Jewish audience. And so he is showing that Jesus fulfilled the Scriptures. Remember, in fact, we have the picture right here. You may be familiar with this. It's Jesus speaking to two people as they walk along the road. This is a depiction of an event that happened after the resurrection. That was the road from Jerusalem, a little town called Emmaus. Maybe you've heard of the road to Emmaus. These two disciples of Jesus, and they weren't part of the 12, they were just two of His followers. They're walking along, talking amongst themselves, and all of a sudden, a third person comes along and walks with them. And they didn't recognize who it was. And eventually, this third person says, what are you guys talking about? You know how it is, you walk in halfway in a conversation, you're not sure what they're saying. And one of them turned to this guy and said, are you kidding? You haven't heard what's been going on this weekend? There was this great teacher, his name was Jesus, came up from Nazareth. And we really thought he was going to be the Messiah, but the Jews turned against him, and the Romans crucified him, and now he's dead. And now some of his followers are talking crazy. They're saying that he's come back to life. It's just so confusing. At which point Jesus says, are you so dense? Are you so thick-headed that you don't get it? I could just picture him smacking him upside the back of the head. Don't you get it? And Luke tells us that Jesus took the Scriptures, again, the Old Testament Scriptures, and explained how the Messiah would come and how He would suffer and die and be raised from the dead. Jesus fulfilled all of that. Doesn't mean that every verse in the Old Testament is a prediction of what would happen to Jesus. But it was paving the way for when He came. And that is how Matthew is using this passage. Now, this is not to cast doubt of the fact that Joseph really did take Mary and Jesus to Egypt. In those days, the city of Alexandria, Egypt, had the second largest Jewish population of anywhere on earth. Only Jerusalem had more Jews living within its city limits than Alexandria did. So there was a huge Jewish population there. And certainly that's how they would have made it. Now people say, well, how could they have made such a long trip away from home when they were so poor? Well, what do you think they used to finance their journey? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Did you ever wonder what happened to those gifts after the Magi, left them? Did you think Joseph put them on the mantle, and said, hey, look at this? No. I'm sure that they used those gifts, those costly gifts, to finance their trip to Egypt and to support them while they stayed there, until they got word that Herod had died and they were able to come back. So every point along the way, God was providing for them. And I'm not trying to suggest that this didn't happen. It did. In fact, it only makes sense that Matthew would include this story if it actually happened and people knew about it at the time. And so we see, once again, Matthew taking an Old Testament passage and showing how Jesus was the one to fulfill the Scriptures. Now, all this is good, and it's important to correctly interpret and understand the text. But there's a significant statement that's made in this verse that we cannot overlook. In fact, I would say it's the most significant statement made in this entire chapter concerning Jesus. Most people, and I got to admit, I was one of them until this week. Most people read that verse, "Out of Egypt I called my son." What do we focus on? First three words, "out of Egypt." And I've heard this stretched and used. I've heard people say that this proves that Jesus was actually African, and we should portray him as a black man. No, that's not what it means. There's been so much focus, though, on the first half of the statement that I think we miss the significance of the end, and that's what I think Matthew was after. The words emphasized in this text are not "out of Egypt," but rather "on my son." The point of this citation is to show that Jesus is the Son of God. Now you say, okay, but what way was Jesus the Son of God? Was it by nature, or was it by creation, or by adoption? And the answer is neither. Jesus is not the Son of God by creation because he was not created. He is not a created being. Jesus is not the Son of God by adoption because it wasn't necessary. He was the Son of God by his very nature. Jesus is God. And even before that baby in Bethlehem took its first breath, Jesus was God. He existed as God before the first Christmas. Jesus told the Jewish people that he was arguing with, "Before Abraham was, I am." And they said, "You're nuts. You're not even 50 years old and you claim to be older than Abraham." What Jesus was saying was, "I have always existed as God." Jesus, the man, was born in Bethlehem on that night so long ago. But centuries and eons before that, he was the Son of God. And I believe that's what Matthew's getting at here. He is pointing to this baby in Bethlehem and saying, "This is the Son of God." And that's the most significant thing about Christmas. It's not about Mary and Joseph. It's not about the wise men. It's not about the shepherds or angels or mangers or anything else. It is Jesus and who Jesus is. And he is the Son of God. Not just a baby. Not just another baby born and a whole line of people that have been born down through the ages. There's something special about him. He is the Son of God. This wasn't just an unusual birth. This was a unique birth. It had never happened before, and it'll never happen again. God himself is taking on human form. And the bottom line of this passage, and you think about it, the New Testament's record of Jesus' birth as a whole, is that this little baby, born to a poor young woman in a stable outside that little town of Bethlehem, was nothing less than the Son of God. And this is where Christmas becomes relevant to each and every one of us. I had mentioned earlier John's first chapter in his gospel. I'd like to go back to that. He opens his gospel with these words, "In the beginning was the Word, The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Now you say, who is the Word? Who is he talking about here? Verse 14 explains. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. Now we know who he's talking about. He's talking about Jesus. Jesus is the Word in those first two verses. And Jesus was with God in the very beginning. And Jesus was God. He didn't become a God. He wasn't created as a God. He was God. In fact, verse 3 says, nothing was created that he didn't create. That baby born in Bethlehem was the creator of the world, of the universe. But he took on human form. It says that he became flesh. Literally, that means he pitched a tent. He tabernacled among us. I know that's a weird word. But that's what he did. He took on a human form. He came and he lived as one of us. But he was God. And that is the message of Christmas. That Jesus is God. And he came to save us. And he came to redeem us as only God could do. No human being could do what Jesus did because he was God. But that also makes a claim on every one of our lives. What are you going to do with Jesus? You see, Jesus came as the gift. You know, we talk about Christmas presents and giving gifts to one another. I had somebody ask me the other week, how did that all get started? Why are we give gifts to people? In one way, it's a commemoration of what happened on that first Christmas. And I'm not talking about the gifts that the wise men gave to Jesus. I'm talking about the gift that Jesus was. Jesus was the gift from the Father. And he came to save us. He came to give us life. But I want you to notice, going back to John chapter 1, listen to these tragic words. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, and his own did not receive him. Jesus came to the earth he created, but his creation didn't recognize who he was. He went to the chosen people of God and they missed it. They refused to receive him. In essence, they took the gift that God the Father had gave and they threw it back in his face and said, we don't need it. We don't want it. And as unthinkable as that would be, come Tuesday morning to have a child, or anybody for that matter, take a gift that somebody had given them and say, nah, I don't want it. That would never happen. And yet, it does happen with Jesus all the time. Just as in Bethlehem, there was no room for Jesus to be born, in the same way in many lives today, there's no room for Jesus. We're getting that way as a culture, aren't we? We're getting that way as a society where there's no room for Jesus. You can celebrate anything else you want, but keep Jesus out, right? But that's nothing new. That's been going on from the very time Jesus came to earth. Now, the good news, repeating again from John chapter 1, yet to all who receive him, to those who believe in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And this is what Christmas is all about. It's all about the Son of God. That's who Jesus was and still is. He is the Son of God by his nature. And everything about that baby echoed the fact that he was God's Son. But Christmas also opens the door for the sons of God by adoption, by allowing Jesus to come in, we too can become His children by adoption. We can be part of the family. Now, there's nothing automatic about it. Just because someone purchases a gift and wraps it and hands it to you, it's not yours until you accept it, until you receive it, until you open it up and take possession of it. God has given you a gift this Christmas. What are you going to do with it? Our invitation hymn this morning is actually the last half of the song that was played during communion. It's hymn number 174. And it asks a very simple question. This is not typically a Christmas song. And yet, when you think about Bethlehem, when you think about there being no room in the inn, I think this song speaks volumes to what Christmas is all about. It asks a simple question. Have you any room for Jesus? It's a question I want to ask you this morning. Have you any room for Jesus in your life? Or are you going to take this divine Christmas present and hand it back to God the Father and say, no thanks, I don't need it. I'm doing fine on my own. Don't want it. What is our answer today? We're just going to sing that first verse. And I hope that your prayer this morning is the chorus of the song we sang before the sermon. Oh, come to my heart, Lord Jesus. There is room in my heart for you. If that's true today, you can have what some call the Bethlehem experience in your own heart. Because Jesus says He will come in and you will be born again. That is what Christmas is all about. We're just going to sing the first verse. Thank you.